All right, good morning, everybody. It is Wednesday morning. I woke up this morning and I thought it was Tuesday morning. In fact, I got all the way into lab and thought it was still Tuesday morning, but it is Wednesday, June 24th, and 10:20 a.m. We're here for the Chem3 lecture. And this morning, couple of things to announce. Number one, new homework assignment up. So that's up on Canvas, and that is suggested homework. I will grab really quick the link for that if I can. There it is. And throw that in here into the chat. So that's the link for the homework and the new homework assignment that's up. That also went out on email earlier. That's a suggested homework assignment. That's a homework assignment from the textbook. So that's excellent practice for you, and I encourage you guys to work with that. The other thing is I put an answer key up to homework number one. And that answer key can be found on chemed.study, and I put a link to that in multiple places for you to be able to find it. So if you go to the Chem3 page, and then from the Chem3 page, you see there is a new link at the bottom of the screen that says homework answer keys. Hit that link, and it takes you to the answer keys where I've got chapter one homework key as a PDF, and in that, I have worked out each of the problems and tried to put a good amount of effort into giving you really good answers to build off of. And so you can see the detail that I put into that for all the different answers, and it goes the same all the way down to the computational components. So everything is there for you. But what I would caution you about, and I've written this into the paragraph that is there, is that, and this is something that is worth talking about, that when an answer key is provided, and I did this as a student too, I flipped to the answer key when I got stuck. And when you get stuck, sometimes going to the answer key can be really helpful to get you unstuck. That is true. But it is also true that it is worth wrestling with the problems for a little bit before going to the answer key too quickly. And that at least maybe if you go to the answer key, that that you do it on the first problem, and then the subsequent ones when there's part A, part B, part C, part D, that you really try not to go to the answer key for every one of those. Try to struggle with the problem for at least 3 minutes before you go to an answer key. And that struggling with the problem is not a bad thing. Most of the time when we feel like we're struggling, we feel like we're unprepared, we feel like we're failing, we feel like we're not meeting the expectations. And that we need some relief from that struggle, and the answer key is that relief. And the problem is that trains you to jump to the answer key. And so any tips for helping with the struggle without looking at the key? What I would say is that sometimes using the other resources to try to learn the material, for instance, going back in the chapter or looking or rereading that section of the chapter again in order to solidify the concepts, that jumping to the answer trains you to go to the key, whereas reading the concept over again solidifies the concept and helps you to get unstuck in finding a way forward in the problem. So that's what I would suggest more so, is trying to go back to the text and trying to look at it that way. Of course, the key is there, and the key is a great resource, and it explains it out in greater detail. And so studying from the key can be a great thing too. It's just that sometimes, particularly within the class, if an instructor doesn't give you permission to struggle, then we think of struggling as a bad thing. But in chemistry, we typically will give problems that can occupy 10 minutes, 15 minutes, a half an hour. In the OChem class, I give problems that take students a week to be able to solve, and actually take coordination of the students to be able to solve, so that not everybody has all the information to solve the problem themselves. And it takes a lot of conversations and a lot of back and forth in order to arrive at the final answer. And it can take a week in order to be able to do some of those problems. At the research level, we can wrestle with problems for a year or 2 years or 3 years before we arrive at a final solution. And so this building up of building of endurance for dealing with a problem is a really good skill. And I think that starting it off and sort of setting a timer for 3 minutes and then going back to the book and looking in the book to try to solidify that concept and then going to the answer key after that, if you're really stuck and trying to find a way out, I think that's a good solution. So I just wanted to give you permission and say struggling is not a bad thing. That's part of the process and it's part of learning. And it's true for learning at all levels and true for learning of all skill sets. So just keep that in mind as you're going through and doing these problems, because I know some of them can be frustrating and some of them can be challenging. And nothing worth doing is easy all the time. All right. So that's one thing, that the homework key is there. And I will put out a key for the second homework assignment too. It's just that key took me a good while to write out. And I'm working with a limited bandwidth in what I can keep up with in lab and lecture and everything else. So I'll keep trying to stay ahead of you guys as I go forward. Okay, so that's there. And like I said, I linked to it from the actual homework assignment at the bottom of the homework assignment in Canvas. There's a direct link to get you there too. So I tried to put links all over the place in order to keep you guys finding the resources. Other thing is I put out a list server. That list server is chem3@cabrillo.edu. And so you're going to start getting emails from chem3@cabrillo.edu instead of me. What I was doing was, in order to email the class, I could either go into Canvas and email out the whole class that way, or I could, and if I wanted to catch some of the students that were in the lab, then they got left out of that. If I wanted to email a lab section, it just got complicated. And I had all the emails in a spreadsheet, and then I had to blind carbon copy them into an email every time I wanted to do it. The list server, chem3@cabrillo.edu, all I need to do is send an email out to that, and it targets everybody in the whole class because I added everybody in the labs and everybody in the lecture. So when you see that email, that's an email from me. I think that right now I have it set up so that you can probably reply to that to me, but I don't think I have it set up right now so that you can send emails. The concern there is that I don't want to confuse chem3@cabrillo.edu with my personal email. And if you send personal information out to chem3@cabrillo.edu, it goes to the entire class. So when you reply to me, or if you want to send sensitive personal information, make sure that it goes to my personal email at jason.camera. Or jason.camera@cabrillo.edu. So watch for the emails from chem3, but if you're sending sensitive things to me, please send it to jason.camera@cabrillo.edu. So that's just going to allow me to do a little bit faster communication, a little bit easier than having to log into something else like Canvas and try to send things out. I can just send them out quickly now.
Hey, Jason.
Yeah.
So that's more so for you. You just blast out emails to all of us, and we don't necessarily need to worry about using that. That's mostly you'll use that to reach us.
Right. Yeah. And so in my Chem3 class, I have it bifunctional that students can send out emails to the list server, and it goes to everybody, and that way they can ask for help from their fellow students. I think that rather than doing that, we have the Canvas question and answer page, and that you can throw things up on the Canvas question and answer page, and maybe people can check that instead of blasting out an email to everybody. I think that's the way that I've got it set up. And that way it just prevents you guys from sending accidentally sensitive information. So it'll just be sort of a one-way communication, me blasting things out to you guys, and we'll do it that way. Okay. Today I want to, we were in chapter 2.4. We were already doing the mole. What I want to do is I want to look at different forms of molecular communication. So what we're going to do is pick up chapter 2.4. Oh, dogs are so barky today. And look at chemical formulas. In looking at chemical formulas, there are different representations that we tend to use for molecules. So these are sort of different representations. We have, number one, a chemical formula. The chemical formula lists the elements with subscripts to indicate the ratios of each of the elements in the compound. So when we look at a chemical formula, these are really for compounds. And the subscripts, the way that we interpret this is that it is N1 and H3, and that there is one nitrogen and three hydrogens. However, what I do is when I write the material out, I leave the one off of the nitrogen because the one is said to be redundant. So anytime there is just a one in a formula, we don't display the one. For instance, if it's CH4 or something that I used this morning, NaC2H5O, where there are ones, the ones are implied but not shown. And so we sort of leave those off from the chemical formula. The chemical formula, all it does is it shows the ratios of elements in the compound. It doesn't give me any more information than that. All it shows me is the ratios of the elements in the compound. And from those chemical formulas, sometimes the chemical formulas can, well, we'll get to some structural information in a minute. Another representation that we can use. So from chemical formula, we can go to a representation that is called a Lewis structure. The Lewis structure gives us atom connectivity. It shows us where the bonds are within the molecule. And it shows us where some of the electrons and things are that are in the molecule. So these dots are electron pairs. These lines. What's that?
Sorry. Is that also called a structural formula?
Yes, we can call it a structural formula. So that's what I was going to say, is that there are multiple names for this. So it is technically a Lewis structure, but we can also give it the name also called a structural formula. Because it gives us the atom connectivity. And so a Lewis structure, also called a structural formula, also called a bond line formula. There are many different terms or ways that we refer to that formula. And it is meant to imply three-dimensional shape and structural connectivity. So we get the atom connectivity. And we get three-dimensional shape from the picture. From there, we can demonstrate another type, which is an actual, well, let me show you.
Sir, for the Lewis structure, which one are you most likely to use? Which name?
Oh, I switch him back. God, I'll use all three. It's crazy. it depends upon what chapter we're in. That's a great question. When we're in the chapter where we're looking at VSEPR theory, then we'll refer to them as Lewis structures when we start to introduce it. When we're using formulas outside of that, probably refer to it as either a bond line or a structural formula. But they're all meant to indicate or be the same thing. It's just different names depending upon what section we are in the chapter as to how we refer to that formula. But it does the same job. It always shows you connectivity and a little bit of three-dimensional shape implied in that. All right, here's what I was trying to show. Is this is a molecular representation of what that molecule looks like. And so in the molecular representation, we have a true three-dimensional molecular representation that now does not have the symbols. So it doesn't have hydrogens and nitrogens or other things. What it has is color-coded such that hydrogens are always white, nitrogens are always blue. And so we can see the three-dimensional shape of that. And this is a shape that we call trigonal pyramidal. We go through shapes a little bit later, not in this chapter. And from here, there are different ways to be able to view this too. And I don't know if I can view this. Let me see. Adjust. I was not prepared for this. No, I don't know how to get it in this app. This app I don't use all the time. And I can't change the representation the way that I want. And I don't want to build and I don't want to adjust and I don't want to. That'll work. There we go. Or I could do it in this way, electrostatic potential. There it is. This is sort of what's called a space-filling model, where we look at the electron cloud that is surrounding the entire molecule. And you can think of the atoms, the individual atoms that you're seeing inside of that as sort of just the nucleus. And yet this would be the electron cloud that would surround that that molecule. And that you can see that the cloud is this very large, soft, and squishy sort of thing in the way that the electrons are around it. And the color coding, the areas where there are red means that there are high concentrations of electrons, and the areas that are blue are low concentrations of electrons. And so this gives me sort of an electrostatic potential map of the molecule itself and where there is high electron density and where there is low electron density. And each of these different representations we use for different purposes to talk about different parts of a molecule or different components of a molecule. And as the molecules get bigger, the pictures get more complicated. So we could go to Job Manager and I can pull try this, another molecule that has fluorine and sulfur and carbon, and we can look at the geometry from this, how it's very different for this geometry. And also when I go to calculate and put in the electrostatic potential, we can see that the geometry of that molecule really changes. And we don't use these maps very often. we use these maps when we get into sort of a Chem 1A, Chem 1B, but really Chem 12 when we get into organic chemistry. We focus on these types of representations. Most of the time, we're not focusing on electrostatic potential maps or those types of things. However, the book was showing a lot of those different pictures, and yet it was showing them to you in a static format. And I wanted to show you in a way that it was three-dimensional and how we can actually rotate that molecule around and we can look at the geometry of that molecule. And so we're gonna go through in later chapters how we actually build these three-dimensional images and how we can tell what the three-dimensional molecule looks like just by how many atoms are connected to each other. And there's a tool that's called VSEPR theory that allows us to be able to predict geometry. And we'll be able to predict these shapes of tetrahedral, trigonal planar, all of these different things. So something that is tetrahedral is like, where did it go? Ammonia, methane. So there's a methane molecule that has four hydrogens connected to a carbon and the shape that that takes on. And our water molecule that we look at a lot. When we look at our water molecule, that is in here. So here's our water molecule with the bent shape that it has with the two hydrogens connected to the oxygen. So just being able to look at these three-dimensional views. Much harder to take notes on, but so what we did there is we also have a molecular view that is three-dimensional and can show the electron cloud. So they're used for all... That, go ahead.
For that, is the color coding standardized or is it standardized within the app?
It's fairly standardized that carbon is usually gray, nitrogen is usually blue, oxygen is usually red, hydrogen, which is hard for me to show, but hydrogen is generally white. So I will outline sort of a hydrogen in that, that worked, that's efficient. Hydrogen is generally white in its color scheme. And then for other things like halogens, so halogens are usually in a purplish color. And what else? I don't know. That's the most of the color schemes. Most of the time what we stick with is carbon, nitrogen, oxygen, hydrogen, and halogens. And we don't hit too many other elements that we really need to deal with because we stick within that range. So that's the color scheme that we typically use. And one more thing within these chemical formulas. When we look at a chemical formula, sometimes the chemical formula can have some structural information. So let's do chemical formulas. With structural information. So sometimes we can have formulas that look like CH3COOH. This formula could be reduced down to C2H4O2. These two are the same, but one gives you structural information . The other is just a molecular formula. In the molecular formula, we usually follow sort of a pattern that we follow metals first. So they always sort of have the metal out first. Then we follow carbon, hydrogen, oxygen, nitrogen, halogen. And for the halogens, we usually represent a halogen with an X. So we could say C-H-O-N-X. That's the order in which that we write them. So that there's sort of a standardized order that we're always writing the carbon first, then the hydrogen, then the oxygen. So they come in sort of that order. And if there's a metal that's in there, we usually put the metal out on the left-hand side. The structural information idea is telling you something about the groupings of how these go together. So that if I take this formula and copy it, this formula is interpreted to mean that the carbon has three hydrogens connected to it, and that's why they are grouped together in that way. And then that carbon is connected to a carbon that has two oxygens on it. That's the next grouping. And then the hydrogen at the end of the molecule. So we have these sort of three groupings in which if I take and highlight out the first methyl group, that's this group here that we're highlighting out. The second carbon with its oxygens. And then the last hydrogen, which is connected to that.
Why is that not written as CO2?
Why is it not written as CO2? Sometimes it can, so sometimes it can be written CH3CO2H. Yeah. This is another variation of that.
Okay.
And also a perfectly valid. You'll just see it written multiple ways, and they're trying to communicate the same idea. They're trying to communicate that there are groupings of elements that are grouped together. Eric, how do I know about the double bond? Because I have to teach you about VSEPR theory, and you don't know that yet. That's going to be something that we're going to teach later. How do I know how many bonds are in a molecule? And so the expectation here is to be able to recognize a formula for what it is trying to communicate, not necessarily be able to rebuild from the formula the structure. It's just that why are these elements not all grouped together such that all the carbons are together, all the hydrogens are together, all the oxygens are together? And the answer is that they're trying to communicate some structural information. I don't want you to be able to rebuild that structural information right now. I just want you to recognize that there is structural information in the formula so that it alleviates the question, why is one formula written one way and another written another way? That's the expectation there. Megan, three hydrogens bonded to a nitrogen. Don't know if it has an actual name. It has an actual name. It is ammonia. So this formula here that I was doing was named ammonia, was the actual name. And why is the second oxygen not at the bottom? Oh gosh, all of these things. The second oxygen is not at the bottom because I didn't draw it that way. And when you look at it in a three-dimensional sense, if I take this and actually draw it in a true three-dimensional sense, what we find is that the carbon has three-dimensional nature to it, and that the other carbon also has three-dimensional geometry to it. And that when I do a full Lewis structure with three-dimensional geometry, a hash bond goes back in space. And a wedge bond goes forward in space. And the straight bonds are what we say in plane. So everything that is a straight bond, you can think of like a piece of paper and holding a piece of paper up. A straight bond would be in the plane with a piece of paper. A hash bond would be going back away from you, out of the paper, and a wedge bond would come forwards towards you out of the front of the paper. No, that comes later. Yes. So are we supposed to know what those different bonds are or mean, or does that come later? That comes later. And then, oh, I see the hydrogen is not directly connected to the carbon. That's correct. The hydrogen is connected to the oxygen, not the carbon, which is why specifically this one, they put the hydrogen at the end and they split out the oxygens, because that hydrogen is only connected to one of those oxygens while the other oxygen is connected to the carbon, thus the different forms of representation. So we're learning that there are different forms of representation as we go through and look at these different formulas. Okay. Along with these formulas, a particular formula can also have different meanings. For instance, a formula which is CH6O can be organized in different ways. One way to organize this formula is to organize it such that the oxygen is placed between the two carbons. And another way to organize it is to place the oxygen at the end of the molecule and the two carbons together. This molecular formula does not indicate which of these two molecules it represents. The molecular formula alone represents both of these molecules. They can both be condensed down.
Wait, wouldn't there be two carbons though?
Yes.
Yes, C2H6O. Thank you. This formula can be both C2H6O, and they both have the same formula. These two molecules are what are called structural isomers. So structural isomers are two molecules that have the same molecular formula, but different structure.
Jason, can I ask a quick question?
Yeah.
So the CH6O that is in molecular formula, and then when you draw it out, are you now transferring it to structural formula?
Yes. So let's say this is possible structural formulas. Oh, that's not, that's why. Oh my God, my dogs are killing me. Okay, and so these are two molecules that have the same molecular formula, but different structural formulas. So these two molecules are completely different molecules. One of them is called dimethyl ether, and the other one is called ethanol. So ethanol or ethyl alcohol. Ethyl alcohol is the alcohol that we drink that is in beer and wine and so that's what we refer to as just alcohol. The dimethyl ether is a completely different type of compound, is a gas at room temperature rather than a liquid. And they have very different chemical properties. However, they have the same molecular formula. So compounds that have different structural formulas but the same molecular formula are referred to as isomers. So those are structural isomers. Can I scroll back up to the CH3CH2 example here? You're welcome. Yeah, typing sometimes. Typing early in the morning. Okay. Are we good there? Okay. One more piece of information that I want to get out of this, and that is this idea of an empirical formula. So let me give you an example. The formula CH2O can be written, or can be a particular compound. Let's do it this way. I'll make sure how much room I have here. I've got to drop this down just a little bit. CH2O can represent this molecule, which is called formaldehyde. But going from CH2O, I can take and I can build C2H4O2 or C3H6O3 or C4H8O4. And that each one of these formulas can be different molecules, and this formula can be reduced down to what is called an empirical formula. The empirical formula has the smallest whole number ratios. In other words, CH2O is the empirical formula for all of these compounds, C2H4, C2H4O2, C3H6O3, C4H8O4. They all have the same CH2O empirical formula that they can be reduced down to. They are all different compounds, and we can write different compounds for these, but an empirical formula is an important concept within organic chemistry, or within, I don't want to say organic chemistry, within all of chemistry, because what we typically do is we typically take a sample. Let me give you an example of why this is an important concept and why the empirical formula in particular is an important concept. When we want to analyze a sample, let's say that we have a sample of a material and we don't know what this material is. So we have a question of what this material is. What we do is we take that material and we combust it. And we do what's called a combustion analysis. And in that combustion analysis, we burn it. And in burning it, the information that comes out of this is we get the percent carbon and we get the percent hydrogen. And we get the percent oxygen. And these values can be determined from the combustion of the material. From these percentages, you can rebuild the empirical formula. If you know the empirical formula, and you can determine how many grams per mole this is, and we know the molar mass. So if we happen to know the molar mass of this material, in grams per mole, then we can use the empirical formula plus the grams per mole information, and we can get to the molecular formula. It's a skill set that we're going to learn how to do. We won't do it in this chapter, I don't believe. I got to look at the rest of the problem set. I don't think we do it in this one. I think we do it in the next one. But this is a common process of identification of compounds. It's how we know the formulas of compounds, or one way in which we know the formulas of compounds is through what is called combustion analysis and the derivation of an empirical formula. So these percentages can't tell you what multiple of the empirical formula the actual formula is. But by knowing the grams per mole, if we know the empirical formula and we divide it into the grams per mole, it tells us the molecular formula. How does that actually work? This is just sort of a visual of how it works. The empirical formula is a fraction of the whole molecule. We can think of the empirical formula this way. The empirical formula is equal to some value, a whole number, times the molecular formula. Or actually, I should say it this way. Some value times the empirical is equal to the molecular. Swapping that around. N times empirical equals molecular. Let me show you an example. If the molecular formula and the empirical formula was CH2O and the actual formula was C3H6O3, then the N value here would be a 3. Basically, what we're doing is we're saying that this value here is the same as that value there, and that we're taking and we're multiplying that by each one of these subscripts to give you these subscripts here in the molecular formula. So if I then take that formula that I've got, N times empirical formula equals molecular formula, I can find N by taking the molecular and dividing it by the empirical by mass. So this is the molecular mass divided by the empirical mass, and this will equal a whole number value. Eric, I imagine there's a way to distinguish between them. There is a way to distinguish between an empirical formula and a molecular formula. For instance, if I write a formula and we take a formula like glucose, which is C6H12O6, its empirical formula is the smallest ratios. So we take the whole thing and divide it by 6 and we get CH2O. And in fact, we would get that lowest possible ratio. Some formulas, the molecular formula and the empirical formula are the same, are one and the same. In fact, it just can't be reduced down anymore. So this is molecular formula for glucose. An example that can't be reduced. You think of something that can't be reduced easily. Well, maybe sodium acetate. Molecular formula, NaC2H3O2, and the empirical formula, is still NaC2H3O2 because it can't be reduced to any smaller whole numbers. It is already in as reduced a form as it can get. Because the sodium was already 1 and this guy was a 3, they can't be reduced to any smaller whole number ratios. And so the empirical formula and the molecular formula are equivalent to each other in that regard, in that case. So, okay, so Eric had something else. Anyway, so that's a little bit about the empirical formula. And we're going to spend a little bit more time with the empirical formula later. What we need to do from here is we need to jump back into the mole, and we need to go and use these formulas now and starting to understand these whole number ratios and use these whole number ratios to start to do what is called stoichiometric conversions. And so the next part where we go from here is to start to look at what are called stoichiometric conversions and starting to build mass to mole types of conversions. It's 11:07. I propose we take a 10-minute break, and I'm going to go figure out why my dogs are barking so crazy, and then we'll start up again at 11. Let's go to 11:20. How's that sound? So roughly 10-minute break. We'll come back at 11:20. Cool.
Vision, okay.
Yeah.
Can you grow up a little bit?
Yes. Here?
Yeah. Thank you.
You're welcome.
By the way, I'm using the notify thing now, and it's so nice. It's amazing. It's so good for making notes.
Oh, the notability? Yeah.
Oh yeah, yeah, notability. That's it.
Awesome. That's good. Yeah, I'm glad people are starting to see that. It makes taking notes a whole lot easier.
Yeah, it's because I think the best thing is that you can highlight something, drag it to move things around if you want to get more space or whatever.
So helpful. When you start and you feel like you've started in the wrong spot and you feel like you need to cross something off or you just get frustrated with the notes and they're not as clean as you want them to be, that ability to rearrange things on the page is so helpful.
Definitely working on the handwriting aspect is kind of weird, but
yes, that takes a little bit. Oh, and when we come back, remind me to talk about rewriting notes as a tool for studying too. That's an excellent study method. So
for sure.
I'll bring that back up too when we come back. But I'm going to go take a break and figure out why my dogs are barking. And I'm going to go ahead and turn the screen off and put some music back on. God, dogs just will not stop.
Contemplate how I'd like to be around all the people in the town with the fancy clothes and things. But I've got time. Stop pushing all your tragedies away. Each moment has got a lesson for the day. Take something with you if you drag your heels in yesterday's or these Saturdays. In the haste, in the grace, I've been up to my waist. It isn't real what you feel when you find love in a chase. I've been waiting for the day when someone takes me away and I never get replaced. But I have got time. Stop pushing all your tragedies away. Each moment has got a lesson for the day. Take something with you if you drag your heels in yesterday's or these Saturdays. These Saturdays now. One more drink, I am running out of ink. Feeling void, paranoid about every little thing. And I wonder if I try to get up and say goodbye, if I'll have the strength to leave. Cause I
Of your eyes into my pockets, yeah. Well, the train skates into Fort Henry, a late Sunday.
All right.
Well, sometimes when I'm riding high, feeling fine, you know there's something troubling, yet it's troubling my mind. So I reach into my pocket for some small change. I reach into my pocket for some small change. Like mercury, so I can tell you when I'm rising or when I'm sinking in.
Sinking in,
sinking in,
sinking in.
Oh, I'm sinking, I'm sinking, I'm sinking, I'm sinking in. So I reach into my pocket for some small change. Yeah. I reach into my pocket for some small change. All right. Go ahead and laugh, cause it don't cost much. No, no, it don't cost much. Here, let's drink from the cup and share some luck. Go ahead and laugh, cause it don't cost much. No, no, it don't cost much. So I reach into my pocket for some small change.
Everybody,
I reach into my pocket for some small change. I stick loneliness, your lips, and the two coins of your eyes into my pockets. Yeah, I stick loneliness, your lips, and the two coins of your eyes into my pockets. Yeah.
Thank you.
Sort of laugh
Okay, coming back here. Let's see what we can do. Get back online. That seems to have gone smoothly. All right. So we're going to transition.
Hey, Jason.
Yeah.
Real quick, I just wanted to say I have Gmail, and I just noticed that the email you sent from the new email that you created for us went into my forums folder as opposed to my primary email. So if anyone has Gmail and you want to drag it, if you drag it to the primary email, all other emails coming from that address will go to your primary folder, because sometimes I don't pay attention to those other folders.
That's a good point. Thank you. I hadn't thought about that because it is seen as a forum. If you do use folders in that way, if you're in a work mode and you're part of a lot of other forums and you feed all of those emails that way as a rule, essentially, then you need to set up a new rule so that you see that chem3 as it comes across, so it doesn't just get stuck in the folder and then miss it. So thank you for that.
So wait, so if my account like doesn't have any like organization things already done to it, it'll just automatically go into the main part, right?
Yeah, it should not go into a forum folder. It's only because Megan has that set up as a rule that she gets a lot of emails from different forums and feeds them all into that way so that she can read them at her leisure rather than having them all show up and clog her email box when she's looking in her inbox. So it's only if you've set that up that way previously.
Awesome. Thank you.
Yeah. Thanks, Megan. That was a good tip though. Okay. I thought I had my dog sorted out, but there's gardeners next door, and there's only so much I can do when gardeners are next door. So that's just the way they're going to be, I guess. All right. So we've done sort of our molecular formula overview that I wanted to do, and the empirical formula is the one important part that's going to come out of that, because we're going to look at empirical formulas later. So as long as you have this idea that the empirical formula is a subset of the molecular formula and that we can figure it out by taking the molecular mass and dividing it by the empirical mass, dividing essentially what is here, the whole by the part. So if we divide the whole by the part, then we can figure out how many times the part goes into the whole, and that's what that n value is. And that's the whole idea behind looking at empirical formulas, or why empirical formulas are going to be important to us later, not right this moment. Okay, so we're going to shift gears a little bit. I'm going to start a whole new page, and we're going to look at this concept of molar mass. And what we did previously is, in looking at the periodic table, we determined that the value at the bottom of the periodic table has two different units. It can be viewed as the number of AMUs per atom, or it can be viewed as the grams per mole of atoms. And so we just say one is AMUs, and the other one we say grams per mole, and has units associated with it. And the way that we use it is we tend to focus on it in the grams per mole more than we do the AMUs per atom. The AMUs per atom is a way of introducing it. It's a way of building into this in this atoms first approach. And so in an atoms first approach, we tend to spend more of our time in the beginning looking at AMUs and the AMUs per atom, and that's how we build the progression. But in the chemistry sense, in the way that we use this value, we almost always exclusively use it in the grams per mole value way. And so we read that as 12.011 grams of carbon equals 1 mole of carbon atoms. And we typically leave the word of atoms off and almost don't always put it there. But it's important to realize that that's what we're doing, is that that value is a ratio of the number of grams for the number of moles. And it allows us to be able to count or to be able to convert between a mass and a count value. So we can go back and forth between mass and count using the values on the periodic table. And the first place that we start with this is just an example, and writing out an example question and demonstrating what we can do with it. How many grams will 3.21 moles of carbon weigh? And in doing that, the roadmap that we're going to use is just going to go from moles of carbon to grams of carbon. And the arrow represents that molar ratio that we get from the periodic table. So this arrow represents the molar mass. And that is 12.011 grams per mole, depending on what periodic table we're looking at. And so to complete out that roadmap, we would take our 3.21 moles of carbon, and we multiply by a ratio that for every 1 mole of carbon, we get 12.011 grams of carbon. And the moles of carbon will cancel, and I'll be left with grams of carbon. So it's just 3.21 times 12.011. So this equals 38.55531. And that's grams of carbon. And then sig fig wise, we need to go through and denote how many sig figs each one of these are. In the number of moles, although moles is a counted value, when we do it this way with a decimal, we're almost always saying that this is a measured quantity, which kind of obscures the idea of a mole, that the idea of a mole is that it is a counted value. However, we don't technically count individual atoms. And so moles, even though they're counted values in this way, are frequently measured with sig figs. The value on the periodic table is likewise measured with sig figs. And the smallest number here being 3, I round this value out to 38.6 grams of carbon. And that's the value that I would report. How does this relate to actual atoms, though? If I wanted to look at, say, for instance, a certain number of atoms, we could ask another question, and we could extend out this roadmap. So let me try asking another question. Let's say, we'll start it down here. How many carbon atoms are in a diamond weighing 1.232 grams? That's a fairly hefty diamond. Maybe we should do something a little bit smaller. No, we'll do the big. That sounds good. How many carbon atoms are in a diamond weighing 1.232 grams? And then maybe we can also ask, How many moles of carbon is this? Or does this represent? That's another way to phrase it. Okay, so in the first part, how many carbon atoms are in a diamond weighing 1.232 grams and are desired, are actual carbon atoms, are given is the 1.232 grams. And so we're going from grams in our roadmap. We're going from grams over to carbon atoms. And the only way to get from grams into individual atoms is to go first to the moles of carbon and then to the carbon atoms. And the reason that that is true is because this conversion factor is the grams per mole from the periodic table. And the second conversion factor represents Avogadro's number, which equals 6.022 times 10 to the 23rd. And so we have the two different conversion factors that we can use in order to accomplish that roadmap. So to do that problem, we started off with 1.232 grams of carbon.
Can you remind us what the Na equals, or with the N with the subscript A means again?
It's the symbol for the value of Avogadro's number. So we have, when we say Avogadro's number, when we have Avogadro's number, we just say, we use that symbol, N lowercase a, and it's very rarely used. I just wanted to use it there because it was an easier thing to write than Avogadro's number. And I wanted to just remind you of that conversion factor. I could have just written the conversion factor. I didn't need to write the N subscript A. But it was on my mind, so I wrote it. Okay, from the periodic table, we look up and we figure out what the molar mass of carbon is. And for every 12.011 grams of carbon, I get one mole of carbon. And then for every one mole of carbon, I get 6.022 times 10 to the 23rd carbon atoms. So this is 1.232 divided by 12.011 times 6.022 times 10 to the 23rd. And I get a value that is 6.1769 24486 times 10 to the 22nd carbon atoms. And then I go back and I look at my sig figs that I had 4, 5, and 4. So 4 being my smallest. That gives me a value that is 6.177 times 10 to the 22nd carbon atoms.
So 1.232 grams carbon, that's your given.
Yep.
And then you have 12.011 grams carbon, which is from the periodic table, and that's underneath one mole carbon. Why? That's that conversion?
It's because of the way that when I look at the periodic table, what the periodic table is telling me is it's telling me 12.011. The interpretation of that value is that that is grams per mole. The further interpretation is that that is 12.011 grams equals one mole, and I need to take my given that is here And in order to cancel that unit, it needs to go into the denominator. And I take my desired, which is here, moles of carbon, and it goes into my numerator. And so then I look back at my conversion factor and I see, where does the value of 12.011 go with? Does it go with grams or does it go with moles? It goes with grams. So then I write that value in with the unit grams, and the one mole goes in the numerator.
Okay. And then you're multiplying that by the conversion? 6.022 times 10 to the 23rd?
Yes, then I multiply that by 6.022 times 10 to the 23rd. So again, mole then I need to cancel, so it goes into the denominator, and carbon atoms goes into the numerator, and it is 6.022 times 10 to the 23rd carbon atoms to one mole, which sets up the values.
Okay.
Yes. Okay. So I'm trying to think of where I want to go from here. Oh, we didn't finish this out. How many moles of carbon does this represent? In order to represent moles of carbon, we could have just stopped at this first calculation. And this first calculation would have given me just moles. If I went just one stop on my roadmap instead of going all the way to atoms, that first stop on my roadmap would have taken me to moles. And so part B, how many moles? The roadmap part for that is just grams to moles of carbon, and that would have been my 1.232 grams of carbon times, for every 12.011 grams of carbon, I get one mole of carbon, and this would have been my stopping spot, 1.232 divided by 12.011. This equals 0.1025726, keeps going, 417 moles of carbon. And sig figs wise, I'm still, wrong color, I'm still in 4 and 5, so I'm still at 4. This is equal to 0.1026 moles of carbon. Okay, so what this example, what I was trying to do with this example was to show that from a mass such as the mass of the diamond that I've done here, I can go either to moles or to atoms, and that the roadmap for going from moles to atoms is pretty much the same. It's just that one more step of Avogadro's number. And in a roadmap sense, what we're saying is that I can go back and forth between mass of a material. Let's call that material A. And I can go to, and that is grams of A as a mass. And I can go to the moles of A, and that this is a count. And that if I want to, I could even continue this roadmap. And I could go to the individual atoms of A, and that this is also a counted value. And that these represent the different conversion factors, one from the periodic table. So this is molar mass from the periodic table. And this one represents Avogadro's number, 6.022 times 10 to the 23rd. And that we don't always go down. Let's see, I'm looking back to see, there was a question there. In the morning lab, I wrote out conversion factors. That was really helpful. It made the roadmap make way more sense. Ooh, you mean writing them out as equalities? I think I see what you mean. Yes, I should do that too. And I will do that. I will do that in a minute. That this roadmap, frequently, we spend most of our time here, going from the grams of A to the moles of A, rather than going to the atoms of A. That going to moles, that atoms are so numerous, there are so many atoms in even a small sample. That it's easier. What's that?
Is A just representing like a variable, basically? Like,
or yes. So there are so many atoms in a small sample that it is easier to work in moles than it is to work in individual atoms. So we spend a lot of time working in moles as opposed to individual atoms. And it just makes it makes the process easier. Okay, let's switch to formulas for a minute, and let's look at some formulas.
Jason, can I ask a question?
Yeah.
Let's say we took oxygen, which has AMU of what, 16, right?
Yes.
And we divide that by Avogadro's number, would that give us the mass of one atom of oxygen?
It's 16 grams per mole. And if you divide it by Avogadro's number, then it will give you the grams of a single atom. Yes, it won't give you AMUs, but it'll give you the grams for a single oxygen atom. That is correct.
It would be a very small number.
It would be a very small number. In fact, it would be times 10 to the minus 24th something. Yeah, exactly. Okay, let's look at some formulas for a minute. When we look at chemical formulas, for instance, water, we can develop some expressions, some equalities. So these are equalities from chemical formulas, really. So while I'm saying chemical formulas, I'm going to move this over and I'm going to write equalities. From chemical formulas. If I have water, these elements are in whole number ratios. And those ratios never change. So it is always two hydrogens to one oxygen. But it is also true that there are two hydrogens to one water molecule and one oxygen to one water molecule. And that these expressions can be thought of as equalities. For instance, I can take and say that there are two hydrogens atoms equal one water molecule. Or I could say that one oxygen atom equals one water molecule. And that in this sense, I am developing equalities that allow me to compare the part to the whole. I can also take and I can compare, in this instance, where I look at two hydrogens to one oxygen, I can compare this one, and I can say that there are two hydrogen atoms equals one oxygen atom. And this is comparing the part to the part, that I can create different expressions out of these that come from the subscripts that are in this, and the one is not shown. But I could take the two and say that this two, and that two, and the two there are all using that value to develop this expression. The one that comes from the oxygen is the one that is here for the oxygen, the one that is here that's not demonstrated, and the one that is there. And then when I think about the whole, I could think about this one as being sort of a value that sits in front of representing the one molecule. That is the one molecule that I am expressing as that value. Does that make sense, where we're looking at the whole and then I'm breaking it down into parts in the way that I've color-coded it out, and that I can write out these expressions in this way and developed from this formula? This is a very simple formula, but I could take a more complicated formula and I could write out very similar expressions. So we could take out a formula that is perhaps, let's do C2H4Br2. And let's write out some expressions that I can say that there are two carbon atoms equal to every one C2H4Br2 molecule. There are four hydrogen atoms for every one C2H4Br2 molecules. There are two bromine atoms for every one C2H4Br2 molecules. And further, I could say that for every two carbon atoms, this equals four hydrogen atoms. Or I could draw an expression to say that for every two carbon atoms, this equaled two bromine atoms. That I could go part to part, and that all of these relationships, are equalities that are developed from the molecular formula itself and the subscripts in the molecular formula. And these would allow me to be able to convert between the part and the whole of the molecule, so that I could ask questions now regarding the whole or the part, and I could ask you questions from these. Let's say, how many bromine atoms are there in 3.72 times 10 to the 16th molecules of C2H4Br2? And in order to do that, I'm going to go through a roadmap that is going to take me from molecules of C2H4Br and convert into just bromine atoms. And the relationship that I would choose to be able to accomplish that, if I'm looking at these different relationships, the one that I'm going to need is the bromine one, this one here, is going to be representative of the conversion factor that I'm going to need to accomplish that.
Can you say that one more time? That really, the last sentence you said? It was a really good one.
It's so funny when you say that, Gary. I'm going to try. But this happens to me year in and year out. Almost, there's so many lectures this happens. And it happens with my Chem 12 students too. They're like, can you say that again? And I'm like, no, I can't say that again. I said it once and I can't say it. It's like gone. It comes out my mouth and I don't even know how to say it again.
It was perfect.
It was perfect. But what I'm trying to say is that the expression that we choose to use that connects bromine to molecules is the expression that we need as that conversion factor. I can't even say it the right way that I need to say it. And my dog is killing me. I'm going to kill the dog. I need to put the dog in a box. Because he just cannot tolerate leaf blowers. It's the leaf blower that's killing him. All right, so the expression here, converting bromine into molecules, is the conversion factor that we need to accomplish this transformation, going from molecules to atoms. So we've picked the right equality in order to use as our conversion factor. And now we just need to write out the equation. So we're going to start off with our given of 3.72 times 10 to the 16th molecules. And this is a C2H4Br2. And we're going to multiply that by a conversion factor that for every one molecule of C2H4Br2, I get two atoms of bromine. And the molecule value is going to cancel. And it is the whole unit that cancels. And I'm left with atoms of bromine in that conversion. And so it is just simply 2 times 3.72 times 10 to the 16th. And I'm getting 7.44 times 10 to the 16th. Bromine atoms. And sig figs wise, this is measured at 3 sig figs, but these are counted and as such are exact. And so I get to keep 3 sig figs and I don't need to do any rounding, and that answer is perfect just the way it is. How did that look in terms of going through and creating these different relationships and using those relationships to convert between a molecule and an atom? Okay, from there, we need to do a progression. And the progression that we need to do is we need to go and ask a different question. Let's take that molecule that we were just using, C2H4Br2, and let's imagine that this thing is a package and that I'm going to have 6.022 times 10 to the 23rd of these packages. And what I want to know is I want to know how many of these guys I'm going to have. So if I have 6.022 times 10 to the 23rd of these packages, And inside the package, there is two of these. Then what I'm going to do is I'm going to multiply by two, the 6.022 times 10 to the 23rd. So this is going to be 2 times 6.022 times 10 to the 23rd in terms of the number of bromines that I'm going to get. If I think about this as 1 mole, because that's what 6.022 times 10 to the 23rd is, then this becomes 2 times 1 mole. Does that make sense?
No.
No?
Not to me.
Okay. All right, let's try it this way. This is what we did this morning. And we can do it in the same sort of manner that we did this morning. If we have 6.022 and we have 6.022 times 10 to the 23rd boxes. This is 1 mole. And do we agree that there's 2 shoes in each box? And because there's 2 shoes in each box, that means that in order to figure out how many shoes I'm actually going to have, that the number of shoes that I'm going to have here is going to be times 2, right? So I'm going to get twice the number of shoes. In other words, if I have a box and I have 6.022 times 10 to the 23rd boxes, then I'm going to get, and we could do it this way too. We could do it in a different color. Let me try this. Let's say that what I have is 2 boxes. Then I would have 4 shoes. And that mapped out because it was the 2 boxes, 2 times the 2 boxes. And that there was 2 shoes in each box. And that's the way that that mapped out. And so if I have 6.022 times 10 to the 23rd, then what I have is I have 2 times 6.022 times 10 to the 23rd. Megan, is that working out in terms of thinking about it as objects?
I think I just need to practice it, but I'll figure it out. Thank you.
Okay. And so what we're doing essentially here is that we're thinking about these, and my boxes here, if I'm thinking about these guys as a counted value, these are counted values, 2 boxes, 6.022 times 10 to the 23rd boxes. And how many things come in a box? The number of things that come in a box, I'm thinking about these guys as 2 that come in a box, and therefore that is the 2 times that I'm getting over here. In the same way that this is the subscript 2 and 2 times what's coming in this box to give me the number of bromines. And as far as a mole number, we can even make this analogy even a little bit better. Here's even another analogy. Instead of 2 boxes, I could have 12 boxes. And that means that over here, what I have, this is even a better way to do it, is I have 2 times 12 boxes, which is going to equal 24 in that case. But on the bottom here, to make this comparison, instead of 1 mole, this could be 1 dozen. And in that way, this is 2 times 1 dozen. Which is going to equal 2 dozen. in the same way that I have taken and I am applying 2 times 1 mole. And this equals 2 moles. These individual counts, 24 and 6.022 times 10 to the 23rd, these are individual counted numbers. Mole and dozen are groupings, and they are used in an identical manner. In the same way that we would count things by dozens, we can count them by moles, and it is exactly the same as counting by an individual value, except we're just grouping them together. We tend to take a look at this formula and think of the number of moles of this formula, and however many of those moles we have or boxes we have, the subscript ratios hold and allow us to be able to calculate the number of moles of that element that comes in that formula as well, such that we can write conversion factors where we were taking this formula and we were saying C2H4Br2. When we say that one molecule of C2H4Br2 equaled 2 atoms of bromine, we could also say that it is true that 1 mole of C2H4Br2 is equal to 2 moles of Br. Now, why do we get to say that? Because we are saying that these are moles of molecules and that these are moles of atoms, and that we are borrowing this subscript as the ratio, as what is called the molar coefficient or the molar ratio. It's another way to say it. Let's call it a molar ratio. Up here, we just called it the ratio, and it was the same value and did the same job. But now, because we're applying it in front of a grouping of moles, we refer to it as a molar ratio. So the ratio holds for both. It can work both as an individual count, or it can work as a molar ratio. And that means now that we can do conversions back and forth between the number of moles of things. See, essentially what we're doing here is we're looking at a roadmap that says that we're going from moles of one material to the molecules of A to the atoms of some other material B, and then we can go back out to the moles of B. Is one way of looking at this, and that these molecules to atoms, these are our individual counted ratios. There we go. I don't know why it's freaking out on me. These are our individual counted ratios, molecules to atoms. And we could say this is sort of a molecular ratio. But these guys out here, moles to moles, we could do a molar ratio. And in so doing, we can cut out the middleman. We don't need to go through molecules to atoms in order to go to moles, because they are all counted values and the ratios still hold. So we can use molecular ratios or we can use molar ratios, and it is easier, simpler to use molar ratios. It's supposed to be molar. So what we're going to do is we're going to look at some conversion factors going back and forth. And we can see that we'll get the exact same information So we can ask the question, given (1.62 moles) of a material C2H4Br2, how many moles of bromine are in the sample? And we can come up with a roadmap that is going to go from moles of C2H4Br2. We can go to molecules, C2H4Br2. We can go to atoms of bromine, and then to moles of bromine. And that's one way to do this. And I suggest that we take that roadmap and we write that out. And the equalities that we're going to use is that for every 1 mole of C2H4Br, I get 6.022 times 10 to the 23rd molecules. And for every 1 molecule of C2H4Br2, it equals 2 atoms of bromine. And then for every 6.022 times 10 to the 23rd atoms of bromine, it equals 1 mole of bromine. So now I have all the equalities that I need. And I can write out that equation. And the equation is going to look like this: 1.62 moles of C2H4Br2 times, for every 1 mole, C2H4Br2, I get 6.022 times 10 to the 23rd molecules. For every 1 molecule of C2H4Br2, I get 2 atoms of bromine. And for every 6.022 times 10 to the 23rd atoms of bromine, I get 1 mole of bromine. And now what I can see is that the conversion factors, the moles cancel, the molecules cancel, the atoms cancel, and I'm left with moles of Br. And if I calculate that out, it is 1.62 times 6.022 times 10 to the 23rd times 2 divided by 6.022 times 10 to the 23rd. And I get a value that is 3.24.
Wait, so that was 1.62 times 6.022 times 10 to the 23rd times 2 times 1 over 6.022 times 10 to the 23rd.
Correct? Yeah, basically what's happening here is that if you look at this, this value of 6.022 times 10 to the 23rd is in the numerator and it's in the denominator. It's canceling itself out.
I thought you had said 2 divided by 6.022 times 10 to the 23rd, and I was confused. But
I think I said multiplied by.
Okay.
At least when I was punching it in. And so essentially what happens here is that, so that's moles of bromine. What's happening is that these molecular ratios and the going back and forth between moles is canceling itself out. And it means that we don't have to go through these molecular to atom ratios. We can simply go mole to moles, because the value of going down to a molecule and over to an atom and back to a mole, those two ratios, it is these two arrows, this arrow and this arrow, which are canceling themselves out. And so I can skip this whole idea of going down to a molecule. I could get around this by doing a simpler roadmap. I can go from moles of C2H4Br2 to moles of Br. And the equation is simply 1.62 moles of C2H4Br2 times, for every 1 mole C2H4Br2, I get 2 moles of bromine, and I get 3.24 moles. And that the value that is this 2, oops, wrong 2 there. And I guess I didn't need to highlight this one. It's really the 2 that are in there, that these 2s can be thought of as molar ratios. Allowing me to go from moles of a part to moles of a whole. So there's that whole problem. So you see the complexity in trying to write out this equation and how difficult that is. But when we understand that these ratios could have dual meaning, the dual meaning is that they can act as molar ratios, or they could act as atomic ratios, either singles or in units of 6.022 times 10 to the 23rd. Trying to let that sit in for a minute, see how that feels. Okay. From that point in learning about these ratios and how we can utilize these ratios, the next step that we like to move to is moving to a question of looking at how much does an individual molecule weigh. And we can think about this molecule as being one oxygen atom, and that for every one oxygen, it weighs 16.00 AMUs. This is from the periodic table. And that I have 2 hydrogens. And that for every 1 hydrogen, this weighs 1.008 AMUs. And I can get the AMU contribution for each one of these. And I can add these up, and I can get 18.016 AMUs. And that this is for the water molecule. And that if I follow my sig figs rules, going back into this, this is 4, so I get to keep 4, that's out to there. This is 4, so I get to keep 1, 2, 3, 4, that's out to this place. And that by the rules of addition, I would have to round this to 18.02 AMUs per water molecule. And then I can tell how much an individual water molecule weighs. However, an AMU is a really complicated value to use. And that when I look at something like oxygen, that the meaning of this value down here can be either AMUs for an individual, or it could be the grams for 1 mole of oxygen atoms. And in the same way that we were doing this concept over here, that we were looking at going down to individuals and going back up to moles, and we found that we could bypass that and we can go from moles directly to moles, we can utilize this idea of grams per mole in order to figure out how much 1 mole of water molecules weigh. So one way to be able to go through and do this is, instead of asking how much does a molecule of water weigh, we could ask how much does a mole of water weigh. And in asking this question, it is the exact same question that we asked above, and we do it in the exact same way. We just change the conversion factor a little bit. For every water molecule, there are 2 moles of hydrogen times for every 1 mole of hydrogen, it is 1.008 grams of hydrogen. And for every 1 mole of oxygen, it is 16.00 grams of oxygen. And when I add those up, I get 18.016 grams per 1 mole of water. And following the Sig Figs rules exactly as we just did before, there was 4. And so I'm out to here, that's my 4th. There was 4, I'm out to here. And I'm gonna round this value in the exact same way I did, 18.02 grams per mole of water, meaning that 18.02 grams of water equals 1 mole of water. And that is what that actually means. Now look at those two values. We had 18.02 AMUs per water molecule, and we have 18.02 grams per mole of water. And that value at the bottom of the periodic table, while that value can be an AMU for an individual or 16 grams for a mole, we can think about the mass of a molecule in the same way, that because it is derived from these pieces of information, the mass of a molecule can be 18.02 AMUs for a single molecule, or it can be 18.02 grams for a mole of molecules. And that the value has dual purpose.
Could you talk about where you got 1.008 AMUs again for the 2 hydrogen atoms?
That came from the periodic table. So I would have to go and grab a periodic table. Grab it from this morning. And we'll throw it into the notes for today. Let's see if I can paste it this way. No, it's not going to let me do that. It'll paste it that way. And then I'll have to delete that page out. It's got a little bug in it in the way it works. Okay. I got it from the periodic table right there. 1.008 grams per mole for the hydrogen.
Okay, cool. Thank you.
And the oxygen, there's the 16. So those values are being taken from the periodic table in order to get those values. Yeah, this was some serious mental calisthenics. Definitely. This takes a little bit of time to sit with. So don't feel bad if you're feeling a little bit lost. It's going to take a little bit of time to straighten it out, and it's going to take some practice. And that's what we're doing in labs as well. And so this afternoon lab, we're going to pick up, and I'm going to do the exact same thing that I did in the morning lab, which is to kind of go through this in the same sort of way and map it all out one more time. And then tomorrow morning, we'll also have some more practice with this, with actually doing some conversions and following through on a worksheet and getting a whole bunch of practice in how do I actually go through and utilize these. And that will make it feel better. It usually is. It goes in waves. And this is something to understand. Chemistry goes in waves. You come into lecture, the material is all new. I don't know what the hell's going on. Everything's crazy. I sit with it. I practice it. I come back. Things start to make sense. We go through some practice. Things make sense. I introduce a new subject, and it's what the hell's going on again. And you feel like, I'm totally lost. None of this is making sense. And then you practice it, and it makes sense, and you're all good, and you feel confident. You feel great, and you come back into lecture, and I throw more material at you, and you feel demoralized again. And so it's these waves and crests of feeling like, yes, I get this. No, I don't know where I'm going. Yes, I get this. No, I don't know where I'm going. It's going to go like that for the next 5 weeks. I apologize. That is what it is. And knowing that somehow makes it feel better. It's like when you go into the doctor and the doctor says, all right, I'm going to give you this injection and it's going to make you feel really crappy for about an hour and then you're going to be okay. And if the doctor didn't tell you that and you went home and you felt really crappy for that hour, you'd think you were dying. But the fact that the doctor told you, no, you're going to feel really crappy. You're going to be okay. It's going to be all right. And you'll get through that hour and then it's going to go away. Somehow that makes it all better. Somehow that makes that hour feel like you can get through it. So just understand that we're going to go through some waves and we're going to go up and we're going to go down and it's going to be okay. And we're all going to get through it together. All right? Okay. If there's any questions, I'll hang on the line. You guys are welcome to ask some questions. I'll be here for a few minutes. Other than that, we are over time by about 4 minutes. I suggest that we adjourn, and then we'll pick it up in the afternoon lab for those people in the afternoon. For those people in the morning, I'll see you tomorrow. How does that sound? Cool.
Thank you, sir.
You're welcome. All right. Anybody who wants to can log off. Anybody who's got any questions, they're welcome to stay on the line, and I'll see if I can answer a few questions.
I had a question about the 6.002 times 10 to the 23rd.
Okay.
Maybe you already, or I think you did already talk about this. But I guess I'm just like confused the significance of it, why it can be used for all of these equations.
The 6.022 times 10 to the 23rd is the value of a mole, and it is the definition of a value like a dozen. And all we're doing with that number, the significance of it, is that there are so many atoms in a small package that it is convenient to wrap them into a group like a dozen. It's just like if you wanted to go in, you wanted to buy 3 dozen eggs. It's harder to say 36 than it is to say 3 dozen. And in the same sort of way, it's easier to say a mole than it is to say 6.022 times 10 to the 23rd. And so we're just using that value as a wrapper for a package that is a very big number of things. That's essentially what we're doing.
Okay, cool. That makes more sense. Thank you.
You're welcome.
I'm going to piggyback off that question. What confused me about that problem is, So if we're using that 6.02 times 10 to the 23rd formula, which I get, like that, we're just, that's what a mole is that. Then, but if we're starting with 1.62 moles of the C2H4Br2 molecule, how can we end up, and we're asking, are we asking how many, I don't understand how the 3.24 at the end is a bigger number than the 1.62 at the beginning.
That is going to be a consistent theme that we see all the way through. And the answer to that is, let's say that you have a box that has two earrings in it, right? And you're going to open the box and you're going to take out the two earrings. The box was the package and it contained two things. When you look at those two things individually, there's twice as many of them as the individual box. The box is the C2H4Br2 and the two earrings are the two bromines. So when you open the box and you take the bromines out, you have twice as many bromines as the number of boxes that they came out of. So if we had 1.62 boxes, then I have 3.24 bromines because there's two bromines in each box.
Okay, yeah, that's starting to make some sense now. Thanks for not doing another shoe analogy.
Sorry. I can find
it's all good. I'm just a smart ass.
It's all good.
All right, I'm out of here. I'll see you this afternoon or in like, what, 10, 20 minutes?
Half an hour, 1 o'clock.
Okay, see you then. Thank you so much.
You're welcome. All right, any other questions or can we log off? You're welcome, guys. Okay, I'm not hearing any more questions, so I'm going to go ahead and close out the session, and I'll see you guys later this afternoon.